This program is brought to you by the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights in the American Founding. If you'd like to learn more about the James Wilson Institute, please visit jameswilsoninstitute.org. We hope you enjoy the program. Hello, and welcome to the James Wilson Podcast. I'm your host, Garrett Snedeker. Today, we're delighted to be speaking with Josh Hammer. Josh is a nationally syndicated columnist and is of counsel with First Liberty Institute. A graduate of Duke University and the University of Chicago Law School, Josh has worked at Kirkland & Ellis and clerked for Judge James Ho of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. A former John Marshall Fellow with the Claremont Institute, Josh is also a law school campus speaker through the Federalist Society and a college campus speaker through the Young Americas Foundation. He's been published by National Review, First Things, Fortune, The New York Post, The Los Angeles Times, The American Mind, and other leading publications. He's also a frequent podcast guest on Blaze TV. Joining us for our podcast is Joe Egler, one of our interns at the James Wilson Institute. Joe, why don't you get us started?
We would like to start by discussing originalism and its discontents. For decades, originalism has been the organizing principle behind the Federalist Society, and one might say for all lawyers who consider themselves conservative. Why, in your estimation, has originalism been such an effective organizing principle for the legal right for decades?
So it's obviously a deeply important question, made only more important, obviously, by our friend Adrian Vermeule's quite provocative essay a couple weeks ago that I'm sure we'll dive into shortly as well. I think, as Professor Vermeule hinted at in his Atlantic essay, there's a lot of historical context, of course, that goes into the rise of originalism. We need to look back to what the Warren Court was doing, in particular, of course, from the mid to late 1950s, all the way up through the late 60s. And then, of course, leading up until Roe v. Wade itself, there was a lot of seeming creation of newfound constitutional rights, encapsulated by cases like Miranda versus Arizona, which Ed Meese, Ronald Reagan's attorney general, famously has always said, I think continues to say, that if he only had one case to overturn in all, it would actually be Miranda versus Arizona. Obviously, to Griswold and Roe and kind of the sexual liberationist agenda and substantive due process and all of that doctrinal nonsense. So the time frame for the rise of originalism, which kind of is identifying its earliest stages with folks like Ed Meese, Robert Bork, Antonin Scalia, perhaps Frank Easterbrook to a slightly lesser extent. It really was, from a historical timing perspective, seen as kind of almost a reactionary movement against the perceived excesses, properly perceived, I would add, and obviously, of course, in my opinion, of the Warren Court. So that was the political and historical context for it. But if you look back, Joe, to the writings of the framers, Hamilton and Madison alike, obviously, who by and large wrote the overwhelming majority of the Federalist Papers, John Jay wrote a number, but it's really mostly Madison, Hamilton. The two of them were quite explicit in their writings that they also resorted to looking at the original meaning of the Constitution as it was intended by the drafters and understood by the ratifiers and we the people at large as being the only meaning, the only proper method of interpreting that document. So the methodological pedigree does go back to the beginning of the Republic. I think the jurisprudences of John Marshall and Joseph Story in the 19th century carry on that tradition. But if the modern history and its kind of resuscitation and its continued success really was historically grounded in this reaction to the excesses of the Warren Court.
Now, just as a quick follow-up, Garrett here, do you think modern originalism's strength comes from its the consensus that it has among conservative lawyers, or does it derive more from its internal coherency, though?
So there's definitely something of a self-reverberating effect. I mean, the Federal Society, there have been numerous books over the past decade written on this, just how astoundingly successful the Federal Society has been as an institution. Within kind of the broader orbit of conservative institutions in America, you know, the much vaunted vast right-wing conspiracy that a younger Hillary Clinton once shouted athwart. I think the Federal Society has been, by any objective measure, one of the most emphatically successful of those institutions. And I think today, you know, along with institutions like National Review, Heritage Foundation, et cetera, it really is kind of one of the true icons of the broader constellation within the American right, at least since the Cold War and, you know, post William F. Buckley, post National Review era. So there definitely is something of an effect where success naturally does breed success. But it is also just a wonderfully simple theory. It is a very, very, very simple, straightforward proposition. I think there's something to that. The simplistic, elegant nature of it does, I think, intuitively appeal to a lot of young law students, young lawyers, young law clerks, practitioners, prospective academics alike. And there's also a really neat analogy, of course, to the methodological method of originalism, to the common law of contracts. I mean, every first year law student takes the common law of contracts doctrinal course. And in contracts class, you learn that the goal of interpreting a contract is to give legal effect to the intent of the parties to the contract. Now, you know, original intent, so to speak, has been largely supplanted by original public meaning originalism as kind of the go-to originalist methodology within originalism itself. But that analogy still should hold true for a lot of people. The common law of contracts should, I think, naturally indicate that originalism is more intuitive for a lot of young law students than other forms of, you know, so-called living constitutionalism, perhaps.
Mm. No, I think that's right as a matter of political appeal as well. Ask yourself, what's the easiest articulation that a politician might be able to give for why he or she might support the Constitution? And, you know, if you're trying to ask yourself as a politician, especially for a non-lawyer who's a politician, what kind of account might make intuitive sense to you, even as a non-specialist, the standard originalism line that we often hear, the Constitution means what it says, has a lot more appeal than trying to get into the nuances of what is the moral framework that supports the Constitution. Would you agree?
Yeah, as a purely simplistic matter, it's just much easier, I think, for a lot of, you know, let's recall, I mean, you know, in American higher education, I guess some colleges and universities have something closely analogous to like a bachelor degree or a major in pre-law studies, but the overwhelming majority of people who go to law school did not major in something called pre-law, right? I mean, I you know, philosophy, political science are obviously common undergraduate majors. I myself was actually an economics major. I actually worked in for a boutique economic research firm for 2 years between college and law school. So for a lot of people, you kind of go into law school not necessarily being lifelong inundated in the language of the law. So there is something to be said for just rote simplistic nature of a theory. You know, for people who grew up, especially I think in certain religious backgrounds, or were just kind of schooled kind of in more classical, liberal, Jeffersonian, founding era American theory, there obviously is going to be a lifelong yearning, a lifelong desire, a lifelong love of a natural law tradition. And that is going to appeal, obviously, to people who enter law school who have those certain life experiences and those backgrounds. But I don't think that's – and, you know, this would obviously be a fascinating way to take the conversation, but I don't think that background is necessarily – mutually incompatible with a profound respect for original public meaning, originalism, either. So I do think there's something to be said for that, though, that just people are coming into law school from all sorts of backgrounds, all sorts of viewpoints. They major in lots of different subjects. Originalism is a very, very, very simple, straightforward proposition. I do think it has political appeal as well.
Yeah, so it was that kind of backdrop in which Adrian Vermeule wrote his essay Beyond Originalism in The Atlantic in March, in which we certainly would encourage all of our listeners to read it. It was provocative, but it had a good number of renderings that we at the James Wilson Institute would hope that any constitutional lawyer would take into account as he or she interprets the document, the moral foundations in particular. Vermeule's willingness to engage those deeper foundations was something that made us particularly drawn to the essay, even if its ending perhaps offered some diagnoses of our constitutional order that we might not diagnose quite the same. Josh, you wrote a piece which hopefully will appear in the coming days and weeks, in which Joe and I were very pleased to receive an advance copy of that, was very strong in outlining Vermeule's central challenge. Can you perhaps give an account of that and give our listeners a preview of your essay and any holes perhaps in Vermeule's argument?
Sure. No, we'd love to chat about that. So, you know, just a little backdrop here. It's actually really funny. So Adrian and I had been friendly for a while, mostly just from Twitter, although, you know, we have a ton of mutual friends. He actually taught at my law school alma mater, University of Chicago, for a very long time. So he actually was himself a professorial mentor of sorts to a lot of my friends and mentors. Mm-hmm. But we became friendly on kind of right wing legal conservative Twitter, I guess, so to speak. But we didn't meet in person until just over a month ago. Actually, it was early March. I gave a talk at Harvard Law School's Federal Society chapter, and then we got coffee for like an hour and a half or so. And he actually at that time told me that he was planning to write this piece for The Atlantic, put it on my radar right then. And, you know, then he texted it to me when it came out. We've been in constant contact ever since then. So that's kind of just the broader context. And I do hope that my piece responding to Adrian's essay will be out by the time this podcast comes out. So I think there's a tendency on a lot of people in kind of the Federalist Society, originalist judicial nomination space to just haughtily dismiss any intra-conservative challenge to lowercase o orthodox doctrinaire originalist theory. And we saw a lot of this. I saw the day of the, you know, Gary, you and I think we're texting about this. Mm-hmm. When the essay launched, there was just a lot of kind of snarky dialogue, both on Twitter and then both on the broader essay space. But Adrian's proposition is a serious proposition, and I think it can only be understood within the broader context of the intellectual ferment that's happening in the post-2016, post-Trump political right more generally. And just kind of to summarize how I see it, I view Donald Trump as kind of a wrecking ball of sorts who kind of came in and plowed over a lot of the pre-existing consensus, a lot of the institutional icons of the broader right, including but hardly limited to some of the ones that we've already discussed. I think took somewhat of a beating when someone of such an unorthodox intellectual pedigree who said such unorthodox things from a capital C conservative perspective was elected. While the president was a wrecking ball, he didn't necessarily bring with him, you know, a 65 bullet points PowerPoint presentation as to what a coherent political philosophy looks like. And in that wake, in the wake of kind of that wrecked, shattered consensus, there's been all these warring tribes and lots of vying factions trying to compete for what the so-called conservative movement, and on a political level, of course, the Republican Party itself, should look like going forward. And, you know, this kind of reached a T, I think, last year in the in what we saw in the skirmishes between Sohrab Ahmari of the New York Post and David French of, at the time he was National Review, I guess now he's at the Dispatch. And the broader context that we saw playing out between Sohrab and David, Sohrab is kind of representing the so-called new right, which I think is a more moralistic, aggressively natural law-centric, justice, common good-oriented pursuit of conservatism. It's the line of conservatism that I broadly personally identify with. I think it has a lengthy intellectual pedigree. I think that this is the pedigree of the English common law tradition, of Burke, and frankly of the American framers, although that's certainly a contestable proposition. And Sohrab was going up against David French, who was representing more of a truer classical liberal, enlightenment-centric, procedural view of our constitutional order and our political liberties understood more generally.
Right.
Now, how that plays out in the confines of the constitutional debate is the originalists who view originalism as a purely legal positivist proposition, who view it purely along the lines of a morally detached application of wholly neutral, wholly pluralistic legal norms. And this is a view of originalism most frequently associated with the likes of Robert Bork, Antonin Scalia, and folks like that, would kind of line up, I think, more readily in David's camp. Whereas, you know, legal theorists on the right, including, we're hardly limited, of course, to, you know, our friend Hadley, I think would be a more natural fit for Sohrab's view. So that is I think the broader context for Adrian's essay on so-called common good constitutionalism. And in his essay, he takes, I think, Sohrab's more political essay and his more political thesis and kind of turns it, or he tries to turn it at least, into a legal thesis, where he basically makes a proposition. And this is a very, very tendentious, I think, controversial statement among many of my originalist friends. But he basically says that originalism was just an expedient, that it was not intrinsic by any means necessary, that it was a pure utility, that it was a means towards an end of achieving conservative outcomes. I don't necessarily fully agree with that. It's nuanced here. I take a nuanced approach. But for some of the reasons that we already hinted at, I do think that my main point of disagreement with Adrian's thesis is that I think that original public meaning originalism, to an extent, is more or less required by the Constitution itself. It seems to me that when a judge, or frankly, an elected senator, congressman, or a state legislator, when he or she takes an oath to support this Constitution, first of all, those oaths always end with that most solemn of four words, "So help me God." So it's a very serious oath, especially if you're a person of faith, obviously. And if you're trying to dutifully uphold that oath, you need to think about very, very carefully what, quote, "support this Constitution" means. And I don't think that an intellectually serious person can really arrive at the conclusion that, quote, "support this Constitution," you know, could easily lead to the Justice Ginsburg, Justice Sotomayor position that the Constitution essentially means whatever outcome you say it is. Now, mm-hmm. I'm certainly not saying that that is what Adrian is saying. But if you read carefully in the second half of his essay, when he attempts to kind of venture from political philosophy and political agenda, which, by the way, I am largely, not exclusively, but largely in lockstep with him, when he kind of moves from that to the realm of constitutional law, I think it gets bogged down a little bit, because what Adrian is saying is that you can basically pick and choose and find kind of clauses here or there, be it the general welfare clause or the Constitution's preamble, some of these kind of magisterial abstractions and take that in the direction that you want to take it on a normative level. It's unclear to me that that is fully compatible with a judge or elected official's obligation under his or her oath of office to, quote, support this Constitution. So that is where I struggle. In my response to him, I try to briefly sketch the outlines of a kind of compromise measure of sorts. I kind of hesitate to use the word compromise because it's not clear to me that it's actually a compromise. I think it's actually kind of just our tradition more generally. But I commend Adrian's essay. I think it's a very valuable exercise in Overton window shifting and shifting the conversation on the broader legal right about what it is our constitutional jurisprudence should stand for. And I think those who dismiss it as being quote, living constitutionalist, they're missing the point because they're missing the broader conversation that's happening on the post-2016 political and legal right and the conversation more generally about substance versus procedure, I think.
Okay. The Vermeule's piece really raises some classic questions about means versus ends. Some critics would argue that Vermeule's constitutional philosophy is a little too utilitarian and that it puts too much and that given that it relies heavily on the interpretive method, it might put too much faith in the interpreter whose job it is to decide what counts as compelling evidence based on his or her own personal ethics. In fact, that's the way that the political left has predominantly thought about the courts for decades, that judges should champion causes and not procedure. How do you respond to that?
Sure. So I understand where those criticisms are coming from. I really do. Now, I think if we subscribed or if we adhered, and this is kind of, I know where I think the conversation will go later. If we adhered to a judicial supremacist worldview where the diktats, the edicts of nine unelected black-robed oracles in the Supreme Court truly were the so-called law of the land that was all-binding and all-encompassing and truly, you know, if a bare 5-4 majority of the Supreme Court's interpretation or misinterpretation of the Constitution truly were synonymous with the Constitution, then I would be much more hesitant, I think, to adopt slightly more substantive procedural theories of constitutional interpretation. But of course, and this is where I'm sure we'll go later, judicial supremacy is a lie. It is an utter lie. It is belied by the rudimentary structural features of the Constitution itself. I don't want to tease too much of that because I know we're going to get to it. But if you accept that proposition, if you accept the proposition that judges are not all binding and that the judgment power of Article 3 of the Constitution, of which it speaks, only directly binds the parties to a lawsuit, then I think that does kind of open the door a little bit more to theories of jurisprudence about what more generally should happen in the given case or controversy, because you're not necessarily opening the door for philosopher kings to rule over the entire country. What you're opening the door to is exercising the judicial power in a discrete case or controversy properly before an Article III tribunal. So that's kind of one way, I think, of responding to the question. I guess the other way of thinking about it, and this is a conversation I've had with, gosh, I can't even tell you how many friends in broader legal right-wing nerd world over the past 5, 6, whatever, how many years or so. But there's a certain, I don't want to call it cynicism, but it's okay. I can call it cynicism. There's a certain cynicism out there among so many of my friends, and I certainly share this at times, that, and this of course applies not just to the legal, but also to the political context. I think it really did animate Sohrab's now infamous so-called quote against David Frenchism essay. There's a sense that we on the right are fighting with perhaps one and a half, if not two hands tied behind our back. Mm-hmm. The left more generally we've seen over the past 5 to 10 years in particular has gotten ever more vicious. They have gotten ever more assertive, ever more self-righteous, self-aggrandizing. They truly have gotten, it seems, to the point, and nothing exemplifies this better, of course, than the cake-baking wars and the various religious liberty debates more generally surrounding RFRA and things of that nature. They truly have gotten to the point where it seems they no longer want to entertain the normative ideas and values of those of a more traditional, conservative, and/or religious background. And they don't want, they have no interest in entertaining those ideas and values in good faith. Instead, the prevailing attitude seems to be something closely approximating, shut up, bigot, and get out of the public square. Uh-huh. And the notion that the proper response to that, at both a political and a jurisprudential level, can or ought to be a purely pluralistic, purely positivist approach to either politics or jurisprudence, something that's rooted in million live and let live, please. That is a very, very, very defensive procedural posture that just seems to me to be a little unsuited as a from a purely utilitarian perspective. It is unsuited for the moment, given how combative and aggressive the left has become.
Mm. Yeah, and I think we saw an addressing of that in Vermeule's essay when he referenced Mark Tushnet's essay in 2016, saying that liberalism or progressive boosters of the Obama and what they thought were was the future Clinton administration. Tushnet's essay urged them to abandon defensive crouch, a defensive crouch themselves, and so. This certainly was not unintentional by Vermeule, right? He's quite familiar with arguments in which you have prudential concerns that have dominated for a very long time, but then even prudence itself has its limits. And then the question is, well, when do you cast prudence off and seek boldness? And right, that was kind of Vermeule's rationale. Why we should be bold now as opposed to continue to wait and play the long game.
I think that's right. And I think a lot of people on the right of center legal commentary or professoriate spaces interpreted Adrian's essay as a more or less direct response to that now quite infamous Mark Tushnet blog post, which to put it mildly, has not stood up very, very well. I think that's an overly simplistic reading of what Adrian was trying to do. He has not identified as an originalist to my knowledge for a number of years now. So he's always been, I think, searching for kind of a post-originalist, beyond originalism jurisprudence that could not just be intrinsically appealing, but also politically appealing. So I reject that reading of what he wrote as a pure kind of snarky retort to a Tushnet essay from 3.5-4 years ago, however long ago it was at this point. But there is something to be said for what you're saying, which is the thematic similarities are hard to miss in that he's preaching to kind of get over our defensive posture and take out an assertive sword and reject the shield. I am deeply, deeply, deeply sympathetic to that. In fact, if we can kind of borrow terminology from like the calculus and like maximizing function, something I haven't thought about in a very long time. I guess what I would like to do with my own jurisprudence is I would like to ideally maximize the extent to which we can have an aggressive, morally assertive, natural law-based jurisprudence while still being compatible with the aforementioned oath requirement. Because that is important. We can't just ignore that. We are interpreting a document here. We can't just go free willy-nilly. But that is that has to be the question. That has to be the question. And eschewing the former to focus exclusively on the latter, to focus exclusively on giving a morally detached, purely pluralistic reading of the Constitution. Again, the late Judge Bork, of course, emphasizes so stridently over the decades. I think that did serve its moment, but I do not view that as being particularly well suited to the present circumstances. So I think Adrian kind of hit that nail on the head.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right that Vermeule is seeking a post-originalist understanding of the Constitution, but he's doing so bringing in a lot of his previous scholarship and his predilections towards the growth of and legitimacy of the administrative state. And he spends a good part of his essay discussing why it has an inner morality and an inner coherence. Now, that reasoning, though, is anathema to many conservative lawyers presently who have spent the better part of the past decade railing against the evils of the administrative state. How significant is it to Vermeule's proposal that he's relying on a very strong executive to bring about this common good? And do you think the natural conservative aversion to greater government power might be overridden by this newfound concern among the Amariites to the common good?
So I will be very, very interested to watch unfold how Adrian's administrative state arguments in particular, how they take shape, and in particular, whether they kind of naturally acculturate and glom onto the thoughts of a lot of young Federal Society, right of center law student types. Because you're right. I mean, it is just so anathema to what the Federal Society and the legal right more generally has been preaching for decades. It's actually fascinating. This brings me back to the dispute on the Senate Judiciary Committee in February 2019 between Josh Hawley, who was then barely a month and a half into his Senate tenure, with Naomi Rao, who was at the time President Trump's nominee to replace now Justice Kavanaugh on the D.C. Circuit. Naomi was a, she has a rich scholarship, rich academic background, background in the Trump administration as far as administrative state issues. And she's without, I think, any, without any exaggeration, a veritable expert on those issues from a kind of traditional anti-administrative state perspective.
Right.
Senator Hawley, who is many things, but he's certainly a hardcore traditionalist social conservative, decided to prod and go back to some of her kind of law school era and post-law school writings, kind of questioning some of her social conservative bona fides. And it was a really telling moment for me on kind of the broader legal right more generally to see who rallied so hard around now Judge Rao, and then who kind of had Senator Hawley's back. I publicly defended Senator Hawley like three or four times just that week. I thought he was asking all the right questions, but if you go back and look on Twitter, it was so fascinating. A lot of kind of the more libertarian leaning anti-administrative state originalists were just so haughtily dismissive of Josh Hawley's line of questioning. And it was actually Adrian himself who got into quite a bit of Twitter banter with a lot of these types. And he basically posed the following question. He said, for a court like the D.C. Circuit, can't we have someone who's good on your issues and good on our issues? And to me, that makes a whole lot of sense. But this actually goes even further. I haven't read the full book, but someone sent me screenshots of some pages for Ruth Marcus, the liberal Washington Post columnist. She has a book on the Kavanaugh nomination and kind of how to be and all that. I haven't read the whole book yet, but the pages that someone screenshotted for me and sent my way show it's a discussion of the Trump White House. I can't remember who was in it. It was definitely Don McGahn and maybe you know, a couple other people close to him. And the conversation that Ruth discusses in this book basically talks about how the social conservative agenda of overturning Roe, overturning Griswold, that really did animate the federal society at its origins, had so come to be supplanted by many federal society lawyers, affiliated scholars, donors, etc., by this anti-administrative state agenda. You know, in fact, in my pieces that week that I defended Senator Hawley, I referred to this as the, quote, monolithic anti-administrative state cartel. The people who just who donate and just care about one issue, which is Chevron deference, our deference, and minimizing the administrative state in general. So all of that is kind of the context here. Now to put my personal cards on the table, I do not agree with Adrian Vermeule on the administrative state. He has had, how shall we say this, quite colorful dueling law review articles with Phil Hamburger.
That's to put it lightly.
you know, Phil, obviously a brilliant scholar in his own right, not just administrative state issues, actually, probably my single favorite Establishment Clause First Amendment scholar ever, actually, that I've come across, at least in modern times. He's truly phenomenal. And Phil has started, of course, this new boutique law firm in D.C. called the New Civil Liberties Alliance, which is a really fascinating endeavor that kind of just does anti-administrative state litigation. So in any event, you know, I was a 2018 John Marshall fellow with our friends at the Claremont Institute. And we actually had, or Claremont, I should say, had Professor Hamburger come out to talk for a couple of days. And look, that is more or less where my sympathies lie. As an interpretive matter, I do think that a sprawling administrative state is largely incompatible with the non-delegation doctrine and the vesting clause that all legislative powers herein shall be vested with the Congress. Having said that, I do agree with Adrian, and I do think there's a profoundly conservative proposition to believe in a strong executive, in a strong president. I think that this is a quintessentially conservative notion that goes back all the way to Hamilton's duels with Madison on the meaning of various Article II provisions of the American founding. It was continued, of course, by Abraham Lincoln, who, in my view, fits extraordinarily well into the conservative tradition. Lincoln was, of course, the paradigmatic pro-executive power, pro-presidential power figure. I think that was largely reflected in the jurisprudences of both Anthony Thomas, Scalia, of course, perhaps most famous Morrison versus Olson dissent, kind of the best example of unitary executive theory. Clarence Thomas, personified, I think, by his Hamdi versus Rumsfeld dissent, which is, in my opinion, a brilliant dissent. So I think a strong president, a strong Article II war powers type reading of Article II is a conservative and indeed a proper, but both a normative and positive a proper reading of our tradition and our constitutional theory. And I think that that is fully compatible with skepticism of the administrative state.
Yeah, I think that's broadly correct. I guess my only quibble with that, Josh, though, is if we're to have a strong executive, isn't the natural follow-up, what are the still boundaries of constitutional restraint under which the executive still needs to operate? This is something I took up in an essay I hope I have published soon on the Vermeule essay as well. But as conservatives, I think our natural tendency is to grant the executive wide deference in foreign affairs, but to commend an executive that is more restrained on domestic affairs. Vermeule would posit that a strong executive is needed in both. And I guess the question is, really, how do you reconcile the strong executive, you know, as the Constitution permits it, with extenuating circumstances and prudential concerns about replacing judicial supremacy with executive supremacy, which is, I think, what it boils down to with Vermeul.
Right. No, it's a very important question. A lot of people who are as pro-Lincoln, as anti-judicial supremacy as I am, who cite Michael Stokes Paulson as frequently as I do, I've gotten this question in my own life. I've been asked, are you not just effectively a monarchist because you support a president who can just kind of openly defy judicial orders, et cetera. There is something to be said for that criticism. It's difficult to fully combat that criticism, if only to the extent that if you want to get really real about this, if you want to like boil it down to the most tangible of all tangible things, it is the President of the United States who is Commander in Chief of the Armed Forces. It is the Commander in Chief who oversees the IRS, which is ultimately only enforceable at the barrel of a gun to pay your taxes. If you want to get down to like the true brass knuckles, tangible, extreme of all these extremes. And if in the hypothetical world where the three branches were to just so vociferously disagree and go to like proverbial, if not literal, war with one another, the president would obviously prevail because he controls the armed forces. So from that reason alone, I think that there's something to be said that the executive branch, in an extreme, horrible scenario, would be the, quote, most supreme. Now, having said that, the framers of our Constitution obviously did not believe in a king. I think any reading of the Declaration of Independence would make that quite emphatically clear. And they took pains to make sure that the people would not elect someone as President of the United States to that all-important office who had monarchical ambitions, who did not want to run roughshod, per se, over the Congress or the American people at large. And the Federalist Papers have this line of thought, this refrain, over and over and over and over again. In fact, it's the very purpose of the Electoral College, mm-hmm. is to kind of temper the is to have a process for electing the Commander-in-Chief whose ambitions will be tempered, will be more humble and prudent in judgment. But if you want to get like truly, truly brass knuckles at the end of the day, only one of the three branches controls the armed forces, and it's not Article I and it's not Article III.
Yeah. Very fair. Very fair.
So on that note, I think that that's a perfect segue to a discussion about judicial review and supremacy. One subject that has been a special focus of your writing, as you've told us, has been the rejection of the notion of judicial supremacy. What is the unique threat that judicial supremacy presents, and why is it so often confused with judicial review?
So at the outset, let me just say that the timing for this podcast is actually wonderful because my first SSRN full-fledged academic article will actually be out later this month on this very topic. It's actually adopted more or less wholesale from a paper that I wrote my final year of law school for my friend and former constitutional law professor, Will Bode. It was on this exact topic. I didn't really think to publish it at the time for a number of reasons, primarily one being of which the career trajectory I thought I was on at the time didn't really incentivize me to do so. But in any event, the paper kind of landed across the desk of Michael Stokes Paulson a little under a year ago. So that paper will be out later this month at Professor Paulson's law school's law journal, the University of St. Thomas Law Journal. So I would encourage listeners to go on the lookout for that paper. So just to kind of dive in here, judicial review, which of course every middle high school civic student learns or hopefully learns, flows from John Marshall's language in Marbury versus Madison itself, you know, those famous words. It is emphatically the duty of the judicial province to say what the law is. Judicial review refers to the ability of Article III of Hamilton's least dangerous branch to execute the judicial power of which Article III speaks in a given case or controversy that comes before a federal court. The judicial power, and Philip Hamburger, who we've already mentioned, has a wonderful, wonderful book. I'm blanking on the exact title. Law and Judicial Duty, or The Judicial Duty. It has the phrase judicial duty in the title. And he kind of like traces this back centuries and looks at the judicial power was and historically always has been understood as the ability of judicial officers to affect the outcome of the litigation before their tribunal, to bind the parties to that suit. Will Bode himself had a paper in like 2008 or 2009 called The Judgment Power, which talk about this. It flows quite nicely from that Philip Hamburger book. It discusses how the judgment power refers to nothing else if it doesn't refer to the ability to bind the parties to that particular lawsuit. Now, where this project goes completely off the rails, there's a pre-Civil War antebellum case called Abelman, 1859, I believe. And I think it's in a footnote. There's a footnote, or it's either a footnote or just in dictum more generally, where the court first hints at this notion that its prognostications would more broadly bind people in America, in the populace at large, outside of the parties to the suit. But it wasn't until a full 99 years after Abelman, in the 1958 case of Cooper versus Aaron. When the court, for the very, very, very first time, asserted that it is the final word, that it is the true final word on all matters of constitutional interpretation, and that its prognostications were synonymous with the Constitution. In other words, when a judge or elected office holder more generally swears to, quote, support this Constitution, according to the nostrum espoused in the Cooper case, that oath is to support the Constitution as interpreted or misinterpreted by a bare majority of the Supreme Court and not support the Constitution itself. There is no theoretical, prudential, normative, interpretive. There is no basis for that proposition. Like they pulled something out of whole cloth. In fact, this very debate, of course, was probably the issue of all issues that undergirded Abraham Lincoln's famous debates with Stephen Douglas.
Right.
In 1858 was. It was the Lincoln-Douglas debates in Illinois. It was the year after the horrific, horrific, horrific Dred Scott decision. And it's fascinating. If you go back and look at those debates, the debates, more so than the substantive issue of slavery, were about the procedural posture that slavery, especially in the territories, which at the time was the great debate across the country, would take. And Stephen Douglas said over and over again that everyone was bound by the Dred Scott decision. Oh, Abraham Lincoln, how could you be such a tyrant, such a monarch to defy the Supreme Court? And Lincoln, of course, said over and over again that Roger Taney, who was the Chief Justice who wrote that most infamous opinions in Dred Scott, was entitled to his judgment as it pertained to Dred Scott himself, but that he would not apply that judgment as it applied to any other parties. And this culminated in not just the language of Lincoln's first inaugural address, in which he laid this out in the most explicit terms, perhaps of his entire career, but he actually then executed that in practice. He issued passports to free blacks in the Western right. territories
right.
In direct defiance, in direct, incontrovertible defiance of Roger Taney's ruling in the Dred Scott case. But nonetheless, in 1958, the Supreme Court in Cooper versus Aaron said what we just said, And that has been imbibed by pretty much everyone on the left and large swaths of the so-called legal right. And it's really quite disconcerting. I think it's only over the past maybe 10 years or so that there's been a resurgence of sorts of anti-Cooper, anti-supremacy thought. You know, my good friend Josh Blackman had a good piece of scholarship. I think it was at the Georgetown Law Journal, maybe in 2018. It was called The Myth of Cooper versus Aaron. Really nice piece talking about judicial supremacy. So there has been a resurgence of scholarship and rhetoric more just generally that is skeptical of this notion that judges are supreme. And of course, just to kind of hammer home the point of all points here, the problem with judicial supremacy is that it ultimately not just defies constitutional structure, it defies we the people of any ability to control our own destinies whatsoever. A judicial supremacist country is not a country that the framers or anyone remotely or vaguely familiar with anything closely approximating lowercase r Republican theories of governance would recognize, because we will have outsourced all of our greatest decisions, all of our most profoundly important and impactful decisions to non-unelected judges on the Supreme Court. That's a proposition that just simply cannot stand.
Right, right. And I think that's been probably the animating impulse of so many conservatives that thought when they elected President Trump, they elected him to enact an agenda. And yet what we've seen at every turn are nationwide injunctions from liberal district court judges from as far off as Hawaii thwarting the president's agenda. How do you view these injunctions? Are they legitimate?
So the definitive piece of legal scholarship on nationwide injunctions that I've seen is from Sam Bray, who had a really nice piece at Harvard Law Review in 2017, I want to say it was. And that was actually followed up as well by a nice article that Jonathan Mitchell had, I think at Stanford Law Review, called The Writ of Erasure Fallacy. I'll take Jonathan's piece first and then kind of work backwards from there. What Jonathan basically says, and I actually know both Jonathan and Sam from University of Chicago circles, know Jonathan a little better, both great guys. What Jonathan says in his article is this notion that judges can just quote unquote strike down laws and erase statutes from the book is simply incorrect. So let's take a good example here. I live in Texas. Mm-hmm. Everyone's familiar with the Lawrence versus Texas case of 2003, which invalidated Texas's ban on homosexual sodomy on so-called substantive due process grounds. If you look at the anti-sodomy criminal statute, it's actually still on the books here in Texas. You can look it up today. If you have any kind of ability to research legal codes, you can Google that quite easily today. Judges do not strike down statutes. They do not nullify statutes wholesale. What they can do is they can enjoin the enforcement of a statute, for example, enjoin the prosecution of a criminal statute as it applies to particular litigants in a particular case or controversy properly before their tribunal. Now the corollaries of that, of that notion that judges do not strike down laws, do not erase laws from the civil or criminal code books, the corollaries of that are that the notion of a quote-unquote facial challenge in litigation, which, you know, I'm sure your viewers are familiar with, but the notion of a facial versus as-applied challenge, a facial challenge would be a ruling that purports to apply to enforcement of a statute in any and all circumstances. That itself, according to, you know, the world, not the worldview, but the theory that I'm espousing here, That itself is a misnomer and a fiction. The Article III judicial power entails no such thing. there is no such thing as the ability to rule on a so-called facial challenge. And if there's no such thing as an ability to rule on a facial challenge, then by definition, there's no ability to rule on a so-called nationwide injunction, where you can enjoin the enforcement of a statute or a regulation or anything of that nature for every situation affecting the entire country. It's a misnomer. It simply does not exist. And in that Sam Bray article at Harvard Law Review, he does a really nice job of going back to the English common law. He kind of pours through Blackstone and all the great English common lawyers to show that this judicial remedy, this notion of a nationwide injunction, which, by the way, was essentially unprecedented in America before the 1960s, and really only gained steam in the past decade. Uh-huh. But Sam Bray does the dirty work of going back to the English common law and showing that this remedy was nothing closely approximating it existed at common law in England.
Just a quickie, Josh, because, you know, we often will hear from the liberal legal establishment that conservatives have found a newly sourced aversion to nationwide injunctions only after the experience in 2010 and 2011 when conservative judges around the country were striking down Obamacare, from their perches in Alaska to Florida, et cetera. Is that any kind of legitimate complaint, or is this just further evidence that of Bray's argument that this really isn't something that is truly novel, but just it's been around for a while?
So, look, intellectual consistency obviously is a problem for everyone. It's difficult. I mean, we are fighting human nature. I think human nature, if I can just kind of philosophize for a second here and go on my soapbox, I think human nature is inherently tribal. I think we are tribal, communitarian beings by nature. We always try to find our quote-unquote team and join our team and root for our team. And there's all sorts of kind of, Darwinian, evolutionary, anthropological reasons for that, of course. Looking back in human history, it's teams of like-minded people who are willing to sacrifice one another, who evolutionarily have survived at the expense of kind of one-off, Ayn Randian cartoon character individuals. So a modern tangible corollary of that is that it's very natural for us to kind of want to root for our team, whether it's sports or politics or anything of that nature. So that urge is obviously in tension with basic notions of intellectual consistency, which I think is kind of what's undergirding your question here about, conservatives who didn't necessarily yell or raise any alarms when Judge Hannon here in the Southern District of Texas or other judges were enjoining, be it Obamacare or DACA, DAPA, the various immigration unilateral edicts in the Obama administration. There's something to be said for that for sure. Here's what I'll to be totally honest with you, I was a little too young for some of those early Obama administration rulings to like have a strong kind of public opinion, and some of them I was in law school for and was kind of learning this all for the first time myself. I guess what I'll say in defense of some of those conservatives who didn't really think much of them at the time and only now thought more of them, there's two things to say in response to that. The first is the sheer volume, which is just what's happened to the Trump administration as far as national injunctions is orders of magnitude more than what the Obama administration faced. It is dozens more. And it's hard not to interpret that as a pure matter of judicial, hashtag resistance against the big bad orange man.
Started a week into his presidency with the travel ban, if you remember.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes. And the other thing that I'll say in defense of, these purportedly intellectually inconsistent conservatives is that, the first instance in modern times of a so-called nationwide injunction was either a D.C. circuit or a D.C. district court ruling from the mid-1960s. But it really didn't start in earnest until the Obama administration. So at the time, it was like it was a pretty newfound, unprecedented phenomenon. And I don't think many people who weren't already kind of deeply thinking about Article III theory, about what the judicial power, what the judgment power means and what it doesn't mean, were necessarily giving a whole lot of thought to this. And again, recall that post-Cooper versus Aaron, this judicial supremacist mindset has percolated so thoroughly through the legal academy and the legal profession that's become something of a near universal belief. So if you're an impressionable young conservative law student, young lawyer, et cetera, you come imbibed this universal logic without thinking about it too hard. I can understand that. But your point stands. And more generally, I would always encourage listeners of this podcast, as I would always encourage everyone, to try to be as intellectually consistent and honest as possible.
Sure.
Yeah, that's great. And then, do you have any concerns about conservatives on the Supreme Court or the lower courts not understanding the threat of judicial supremacy? Where are legislators and why do they confuse judicial review, which is a legitimate power of our judicial branch, with the notion of judicial supremacy?
So there's not a whole lot. You know, the judicial supremacy debate has to emanate from we the people. And the most natural way for that to happen is through our elected officials, through senators, congressmen, the executive branch, and then obviously also at the state level. Arguments against the notion that the U.S. Supreme Court is the all-encompassing, final and exclusive arbiter of all that is justice and right in the world is a debate that has to happen necessarily from kind of outside the confines of the nine black-robed oracles themselves. Justice Thomas, for his part, has intimated many times that he does not subscribe to this. He has a footnote, if I believe, in the Gamble versus United States concurrence from last term that he basically says this is a lie. I want to say he intimated again in the sports gambling case, Murphy of 2018, I think it was. Don't quote me on that one, but in any event, Justice Thomas has said this numerous times. And Justice Scalia, I don't know if he ever publicly said it, but I've definitely seen Robbie George publicly say that he had private conversations with Justice Scalia. You know, they were close friends, obviously. And Justice Scalia said numerous times that this was a fictitious lie as well. Mm-hmm. But the revolt has to happen fundamentally from outside of the judicial system. It has to happen with legislators on the Senate Judiciary Committee and on the Senate floor, as it happened most fundamentally with the president. I mean, Abraham Lincoln is the Republic's greatest statesman, I would say in general, but certainly on this issue. He is without question the greatest historical example of what not just rhetorically, but substantively fighting back against an all-powerful judiciary looks like.
Right.
And, you know, I thought that Trump had a brilliant, a perfect opportunity to do exactly that, to so-called pull an Abraham Lincoln last summer on the census citizenship case debate. I thought that was a wonderful opportunity for him to truly go all the way, so to speak, and say that we will, you know, apply this to the cases or to the party before the suit, but we will not recognize it as a broader principle. He didn't do that. And I was a little disappointed at the time. It's actually one of my hopes for President Trump in a prospective second term. I think a second term Trump could feel potentially unleash enough on a number of issues, this being but one of them. But I would love to see President Trump go, quote, all the way and pull full Abraham Lincoln sometime in the second term. I think he's uniquely well suited to doing so. I think he genuinely does not seem to care about the inevitable blowback that would come to that. A lot of people are calling him kind of a, you know, fascist authoritarian anyway, so I don't think that would grind his gears very much. And he seems to kind of harbor an innate disdain for judicial power to begin with. I mean, we can always remember, you know, who can forget his tweet about the so-called judge, right? So right. He seems to kind of harbor this intrinsic disdain for the judicial branch. So I think he is very well suited to doing it. And I actually really, I hope he does so.
You know, these discussions that we've had today, they make me hopeful, Josh, you know, in that there are people like you who are on the front lines and are making these arguments in the public square. But what it also makes me pessimistic about, though, is that while these arguments, I think, are coherent, what is broadly lacking is courage and to make these arguments within the halls of Congress and at the highest levels of the executive. And with that in mind, as a prudential matter, maybe our only hope in the short run is to actually have members of the federal judiciary make this argument, because they still have the best outlet by which to cut through the fog of any pressing issues, and to make this argument in a case or controversy that seems naturally suited.
As a purely prudential matter, that's probably right. I'm enough of a skeptic and pessimist on all things political to say that that's probably right. I'm kind of a quintessential Burkean conservative, so I'm nothing if not a skeptic of all things that come before me in the realm of politics in particular. I generally look upon our political class as, if I can kind of paint with a very, very, very broad brush, as being a bunch of kind of feckless cowards. So my hopes are not high, for someone to take the stand that needs to be taken. So you're probably right. For a short term, possibly midterm matter, our hopes are probably best for this to kind of gain traction within the judiciary itself. And by the way, a tangible, concrete instance of that would be the Supreme Court granting cert and ruling the correct way on the constitutionality of nationwide injunctions. That would be the most profound anti-judicial supremacy advancement that the judicial branch could probably ever produce. And I actually don't think it's outside the realm of possibility. I'm not convinced the votes for that are there right now. Clarence Thomas in his Trump v. Hawaii concurrence has already indicated he's there. I find it hard to believe that there are not at least one or two other votes for him. I'm not sure we have five for that proposition quite yet. It was a lone concurrence, lest we forget, from Thomas and Trump versus Hawaii. But that would be a hugely successful, very tangible thing that the court could do to advance this cause.
Mm. So, Josh, we don't have too much time left, but we do want to be able to ask you one more question. And I guess it would be a question that people who are most interested in these issues, but they want to get a firmer hold on where the hottest debates are happening in the conservative legal movement, where do you think they would be best served reading closely? What are some topics that you think would be most helpful for people who are trying to feel these issues out? Would it be going back to the Federalist Papers, or do you think there are some really sharp scholars that are shedding light on these subjects presently?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Great question. You can't go wrong, obviously, with starting with the American founding itself. And there's no better entryway to doing so than actually reading the Federalist Papers. People who don't have enough time in their hands to read every one, I think, can, just do a quick Google search and figure out what the most important papers are quickly. But, you start with the obvious ones. 10, 31, 39, 45, 51, 78, 665, which is the impeachment one that was in the news a lot recently. You know, there's that's a great place to start. You know, I think Lincoln scholarship is also a great place to start. Abraham Lincoln, he's my hero of all heroes. I'm proudly born on his birthday. In my opinion, Abraham Lincoln was the one who brought America's founding into fruition. And, you know, Harry Jaffa is, of course, the great natural law scholar who's most closely affiliated with this proposition of advancing Lincoln as kind of the one who truly brought Jefferson's rhetoric in the Declaration and made it into America's national DNA, so to speak. So I think Harry Jaffa's scholarship would be another great place to look. Of course, that would involve looking at the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which we've already talked about. I would encourage also to look at books about John Marshall and Joseph Story, two of the great 19th century jurists who I think both in their own ways did immense good in continuing and explicating and extending what was the very rich, vibrant, centuries-long English common law tradition that we inherited from our Anglo forebears. They were both brilliant and I think profoundly conservative men, actually, in their own ways. So that would be a good place to start as far as kind of older 18th, 19th century based readings. As far as some more modern scholars, Michael Stokes Paulson, who I've mentioned already, is my single favorite constitutional law scholar on all issues pertaining to the judicial supremacy debate. He's written a number of excellent law review articles on this, and kind of just like easier to digest essays. He would be a great place to look. Keith Whittington is a colleague of Robbie George's in the Princeton Politics Department, is another fabulous writer on all things pertaining to the judicial supremacy debate. I think just a very sharp legal thinker more generally. You know, I mean, just kind of more generally, as far as just like websites to throw out there, you know, I think the Law Liberty website hosts a lot of really nice. Yeah.
They're wonderful. Richard Reich is a good friend. Oh, they just consistently churning out quality essays.
Yes, absolutely. No, they're consistently turning out good work. I try to read publications like First Things, Public Discourse fairly regularly. You know, there's lots of places on the broader web to look as well. Philip Hamburger, who I mentioned, another one of my very favorite scholars, his First Amendment scholarship is just so rich. It's really wonderful. But you know, hopefully that's enough of a teaser for now.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have. We had a really great time speaking with you and putting all these questions past you. So thanks so much for that. And we really look forward to seeing your article in Public Discourse.
Thank you so much. It'll actually be going up at the American Mind, Claremont Institute's new online outlet. But it'll be wonderful to have that up there. And I really appreciate you guys having me on. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Josh.
This program has been brought to you by the James Wilson Institute on Natural Rights in the American Founding. If you'd like to learn more about the James Wilson Institute, please visit jameswilsoninstitute.org. Thanks for listening.